The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
The following is a conversation between Jeff Walker, chairman of New Profit, and Denver Frederick, host of The Business of Giving, on AM 970 The Answer in New York City.
If I were to describe my next guest, the words I would use would be curious, eclectic, collaborative, and mindful. Those are wonderful attributes to have when you're looking to identify some new ways to solve some very old social problems. He has been an executive with J.P. Morgan Chase, teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School, and has served, or is serving, as the chairman of more nonprofit boards than you can count. Places like the Quincy Jones Music Consortium, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, and New Profit. He is Jeffrey Walker, who is all of the above, and so much more. Good evening, Jeff, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Hey, Denver. How are you?
Doing great. You know, when I look at your approach to problems, Jeff, whether they're of the business or the social variety, much of that has been informed by music, which I know you love. When and where did that love affair begin?
I can't go a week without listening to live music. And so that started when I was in seventh grade and walked into the band room, and the band director looked at me in tall braces. You're going to play the sousaphone. Oh, okay. And the tuba. Okay. So I started playing. And you can't really solo too much as a tuba player, so you have to play with others. And so thinking about, you know, working with others to create a sound is kind of where I started, platform, and I built from there. Mm-hmm. And I played in every band, jazz band, wind ensemble, concert band, everything else. And so I took a love of music and working with others to create something beyond myself. And my dad worked at the Apollo program, on the Apollo program in the Moonshots. And so I was impressed that he was working on something that clearly he couldn't do by himself either. And so this feeling of collaborating, of playing together with others has stayed with me my whole life. I think it's actually the theme of my life, is building those ensembles.
Yeah, yeah. And what is it about those ensembles that you have found to be so instructive in the way you have solved problems in both your business and your social service career?
Well, to be a good jazz player, for example, you have to play well, so good. That's yourself. And then you have to listen well, because others are playing different sounds and you're riffing off of them. And that you have to then create this sound that you're both working on together so you'll have an impact on an audience. And that's how I think these ensembles of change that I'm involved in, many, many of them, try to do. You have to listen well. You have to build collaborative strategies and processes. You have to look at yourself and make yourself better. That's a self-inquiry process. Mm. And so thinking about, you know, the successful ensembles, they almost always talk about it as a religious event when it works well. Something spiritual just happened. How are we working that well together? Mm-hmm. It's like, feels great. You know, how do we do that? And I continually look for that feeling, trying to unite people together to have that exciting, you know, opportunity to make the world a better place, but do it together.
Yeah. What's the feeling you get when you listen to live music? Because as you say, you try to do it every week, and I know you often try to do it at least twice a week if you can swing
it. That'd be nice. Depends on the city I'm in, actually. So it's in a group of other people listening, mm-hmm. and they're reacting. And so the people on stage are having to get feedback from the audience and understand, this is working or not working, and here's the sound. So I still love recorded music, but that live feeling has another, you know, essence to it. You know, I'm a big meditator and with others in a crowd. And I think that the experience is different because you're getting that energy from others. And I hope someday to measure that, what that energy really is. I believe it's there somehow. But I think the ensembles do that.
Yeah. Well, this ensemble concept may have been the springboard for a book you co-authored with Jennifer McCrae a number of years ago called The Generosity Network. And it's about changing the perspective of the world regarding working on the big causes of the day. How do you see that perspective changing?
Well, we're all learning how to do this better and better, and understanding it's not one answer that's going to save the world. It's not one individual, or it's really going to be a more collaborative process. And so Generosity Network, and it's a course at Harvard now, actually going to guest teach in it this Monday. And it's all about lowering walls between donors and doers, people that are actually doing the work and people that are actually potentially funding it. And there's all sorts of other stakeholders involved in the process, but there's actually walls that are up Because donors typically would say, well, you have to apply to me and have to apply for funding and I'll evaluate you. And then it creates fear. It creates fear from the donor side, thinking, am I making a good investment here, or they just want me for my money? And then from the doer side, you know, they're sitting there going, how do I get, you know, resources? And, you know, am I going to scare away this person? And so there's all these fears.
Yeah.
And so if you can address the fear part and lower the wall and start saying, what do you want? What are you passionate about? How can I help you? And so I'm not going to be treated just like a checkbook. I'm going to be treated like a partner who's going to help solve a problem that we're all going to work on together, and we each bring different resources to the table. And that's what the Generosity Network's about. It's ways to build those connections, to understand it's not about, gee, the person raising money in a nonprofit, the development person, that's their job. And if I'm on the board or if I'm another officer, and I don't have to worry about it because I'm not a development officer, well, that's just not right.
Yeah.
You know, it's a partnership and it's a relationship. And I don't even call them development officers anymore. These are major relationship people. Mm-hmm. People are kind of like helping us connect to others in a deep way.
Yeah. And it also fosters, I think, the way we have it now, a lot of dishonesty. I've worked with many nonprofit organizations. You're never going to tell a donor about the risk that their investment might fail. And you're probably going to be inclined to kind of fudge the overhead a little bit to keep it lower. So that whole sense of just a really open, honest dialogue is completely lost.
Lose the sell. You know, it's not about selling. You know, it's about collaborating.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about collaborating, what about philanthropists collaborating together? You know, we see them to tend to work in silos quite a lot. I mean, it's my money, it's my idea, and it's my way. Are there some tools and techniques to try to bring philanthropists together around a common cause with a measurable impact?
Yeah, I love that, measurable impact. You know, what are we going to have done, but do it in a collaborative way? We've developed a lot of different things. You know, we have things called Jeffersonian dinners where you're sitting there going, why don't we get people together around a table, have a whole table conversation, and actually share knowledge with each other, develop and lower walls, you know, between them, saying, hey, we can potentially solve things together. And, you know, I'm getting something out of this.
Mm.
I'm actually enjoying this conversation. I'm actually enjoying this dinner, you know. I'll come back. Let me do that again.
And as you say, it's one conversation at a table. It's not
just one.
Seven conversations among 14
I
people.
I cannot do, you know, 1,000-person dinners where everybody's talking to each other next to them about their dog. You know, actually having a conversation with intelligent people is my joy. And so that's what we have to do. So there's all sorts of different ways to start bringing people together, particularly donors, so that they see there's advantage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually more fun. So that, you know, I would get together with some of my friends and say, I really want to have an impact, for example, on early childhood. If that's what your joy is too, I'll hook you up.
Mm.
And music or whatever it might be. And so let's bring these people together. And isn't that the role of an ensemble player? Isn't that the role of an orchestrator to help unite people around these common causes? And when you do that, the energy goes up, the joy goes up, the resources start rising again. And so we're starting to see that not just in small donors, but very large donors, very large foundations start to understand that partnerships are probably really critical for our long-term success. And they're re-looking at it in this what we're calling system change models.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you look at these larger system questions and how do you join together with other influencers to affect the change you want to see?
Yeah. And it also requires a little bit of a redefinition of what success is, because we have a very classical way of my organization and how much have I done, but really it's now got to be more around the issue than really around the organization.
Problem focused.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, let's give us an example here, starting with malaria, because I think that's an absolutely great one. And your role there was Vice Chairman of the United Nations Secretary General Envoy's Office for Health, Finance, and Malaria. How did you look at tackling that huge challenge?
I got involved after, in the process, but when I was retiring out of J.P. Morgan, a guy named Ray Chambers connected me up. And Ray is one of my life gurus, kind of like understands how to go after.
He's quite the guy.
Certain of the problems in the world. And you find those, right? You try to be them, but also find them. So Ray said, come on board, work with me, something called the Millennium Promise first. And then Ray moved over to malaria after he saw some kids dying in Malawi at feeding stations, and I happened to be with him. So he said, let's get together and let's figure this out. So Ray did an amazing job setting up things like Malaria No More and others, and we were helpful in the process. But I actually said, you know, malaria is a great example of system change, and I've written about it, I've analyzed it, and it was one of the early ones that we started looking at, saying, how did all these these individual or organizations come together and have a common goal of lowering malaria, deaths from malaria, down to near zero.
Mm.
How did that happen? And did it work? Well, we set a goal of 10 years,
mm-hmm.
used the Millennium Development Goals as that common measure that we could go after, and we didn't quite accomplish it in the 10 years, but it went from around 1 million to deaths per year down to below 200,000 a year. So 1 million people a year's lives have been saved.
Pretty good.
And it's not because of one person. You know, it was because there's an orchestration, there's a collaboration. People have been working on malaria for hundreds of years, but in particular a lot of money over 20 or 30 years. But somehow this shifted the conversation. It made it so the USAID and, you know, the World Bank and Partners in Health with Paul Farmer and Harvard and all these different stakeholders came together, President's Malaria Initiative, to have a common cause. And how do we measure that? And so we said, well, we're going to measure it so everybody knows if we're going closer or not. Oh, we've got to get bed nets. You know, these are the things mm-hmm. we use to stop the mosquitoes from coming in and insecticide impregnated. How we work with Sumitomo. How do we get production going? It became all the questions that we as old, raise an old private equity guy, and so am I. And so we look at kind of going, what levers can we pull? Oh, we need financing for the bed nets. How do we go to the goal? Oh, well, we need more production. Let's think about that one. So instead of just taking, you know, a siloed global health approach, let's start opening it up to lots of other different stakeholders who can contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And let's also make sure that we're working with the governments so that it's sustainable. So it's not us, the outside world, coming in, you know, helping, you know, these poor people. It's actually working in partnership with individuals, philanthropists, faith-based leaders, and others, like in Nigeria, which we did, to affect the change.
How do you get something like that started? What was the moment? I mean, was it Ray? I mean, what was the moment that you were able to bring that force to bear on this problem?
There was the moment of, let's do this,
and that
was in Malawi, saying, oh, we have to figure out how to do this. And then the process of, let's start pulling some people together to talk about what do we do.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know it was going to be bed nets, you know, and we didn't exactly know all the people we were going to bring to the table.
I got you. So you didn't have the answers, but you had the questions.
That is the biggest advantage I know in life, to not have answers, is actually to understand what the questions can be and should be, right? And so that's the fun part, is asking people these questions about, what do we do now? What do you think? Hmm. You know, and how does this come together? And let's have some Jefferson dinners. Let's have some convenings, you know, and talk about this. We actually did one the White House helped with, and then Gates helped with. And that's almost too easy to say because it's hard to do. But you can do this in a micro way too, by
mm-hmm.
the way. You know, local community, et cetera, bringing people together to say, what do we think we ought to do? How do we join together to kind of figure that one out? But also leveraging your network. I think that's the joy, honestly, of being as old as I am and thinking, I actually lived a decent life, I think, but I have a lot of people I know, and I can use my networks. And you know, my network's getting better and better because I'm not here to sell anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to find some other people to work on these really interesting issues and complex puzzles so we have fun playing together.
Yeah.
And it does. I do this all the time, and it's so fun to do that and find other people to get energetically interested as well.
It sounds like also that a little bit of humility goes a long way. So when you start out these things with that sense of humbleness, it's amazing the things that you can do. Let's return to your love of music. That only stands to reason that you love to be able to bring music and make it available to kids all across the country. Now, that is a very big goal. What do you do to start that?
So we started this conversation with Jennifer McCrae and a guy named Quincy Jones. And Quincy's a well-known record producer. I'm not sure young kids these days remember Quincy, but he is. And he's Q, and he's such a great guy. So we kind of sat there in his foundation, and he was going to give some money to an orphanage in Cambodia. And we said, great, that's awesome. And let's do some more things. And we said, Q, what about music, you know? Shouldn't you do something in the music world? And kind of what really moves you? And we start talking about kids and the kids that don't have it, particularly the kids in the inner city, that the schools have been closing down music programs left and right.
First thing to go.
And there's some things around like VH1, and there's nonprofits. There's a great one, Little Kids Rock by David Wish Runs, and there's Mr. Holland's Opus and a bunch of others. Well, said, do we just back them? And you're kind of going, that's not what we did in malaria. What if we did something similar here in the music space? So over time, we brought Berklee College of Music together. We brought the teacher unions together. We brought people in each of the cities together. And there's 70 nonprofits, and we bring them into the room, and we got the Grammys to say, we're willing to be that incubator, that orchestrator, because we don't have all the answers, but we care about music, and we have a lot of artists that care about music with the Recording Academy. And so let's work on this together. And so rather than focusing just on an NGO, to work with, we started saying, let's focus on cities. And so we picked Philadelphia and Nashville, for example, to say, do we share common goals? That the problem is we want kids to have more exposure to music. I grew up with music, and I think it transformed my life.
Yeah.
It teaches leadership, and it teaches, you know, scores go up. There's lots of evidence of what happens. So let's make sure that all kids K through 6 have music. They're taking some music program in school, not after school. And then let's make sure kids 7 through 12 have culturally relevant music. Now, that was the whole, you know, we had days of discussions and negotiations. Because
I can hear the debates.
I'm not here to say, you know, Long wants to teach classical music. Awesome. But it doesn't fit every city. You know, and Low Catch Rock wants to teach modern rock. Awesome. But it doesn't fit every city.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we say we're going to empower instead the head of the music programs in each of the cities to figure out what's culturally relevant so we motivate the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we motivate the parents, too. When the parents get around this, the energy goes up. The kids show up at school more often. And so that's what we did. And so we have some common goals by city. We're helping them raise resources. We're helping them network. We're helping artists now start taking ownership of the cities themselves and saying this is important to them, bring social media strategies around this one. So we have all these different NGOs. We've got lots of different academic institutions that prove the results, as well as provide teaching talent and some other things. And so it's really fun. And now we're finding more and more people who are joining with us in the Grammys Music Education Coalition we set up and co-founded and saying, join with us to do this. It's a blast. And so people are kind of going, oh, okay, that sounds fun to me. Mm-hmm. And we are having a blast.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fabulous, Jeff. And I do love your concept that you bring to these things of the toolbox, of making these tools available and then letting those local people decide what they want and how they want to use it. Because once you try to foist it upon them, it's never going to work. And because how would you know? You know? And they own it a little bit more. Well, let's continue along that same line. And, you know, there's been tremendous positive change that has occurred as a result of the efforts of social entrepreneurs. I mean, they have really achieved some remarkable results. But if we're going to dramatically increase the level of that change, it's going to take something called systems entrepreneurs. And I know you co-authored a piece about that in the Harvard Business Review a while back. What is a systems entrepreneur?
Systems entrepreneur is an orchestrator. It is someone who can have that managed ego to say, I have questions, but I don't have the answers, but I'll help pull together those that might have some answers or might have some approaches. And so there might be several different innovations, several different social entrepreneurs and enterprises that we can unite for a common goal. We might need to figure out that there's some communication awareness strategies. We've got to make people aware of these solutions. You know, if nobody knows about them, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know? Maybe we ought to work with somebody in the system itself, in the school system. You know, who's in the school system that can be our partner so that they'll take responsibility when we bring these innovations in to embed it? So when we stop, when we as philanthropists stop, it stays. And that sustainability is a big issue. And so the system entrepreneurs share data, share best practices, and most of them, this is Ray and our team, you know, around malaria, they're small teams.
Mm-hmm.
And they leverage opportunities to say, what if we as philanthropists fund not just social entrepreneurs? Social entrepreneurs are really important, and most of them are key innovators. But how do we fund this other group that helps unify it around this common problem and has a set of tools that they can use to unify people? One is, what's the common problem? Well, in music, we figured out it was lack of K through 6, 7 classes. Let's measure that. So it drives you to the measurement when you identify what the problem is. And then number two is, there's some things called system mapping. A consulting firm called FSG helped create it along with BridgeBand and others. So let's map who cares about the problem. If you map who cares about the problem, you may have partners.
Yeah, who are the influencers?
Influencers, partners, opportunities, levers, whoever that. But so don't then drive to the problem. Drive to the answer until you have identified the problem and those who care about it. And then you can say, now let's figure out what to do about it together. And that's what a system entrepreneur does, is start to introduce a number of these tools to figure out this larger systematic change. And systematic change can be large things like the Freedom Fund does, focusing on slavery, the 42 million people in the world that are enslaved, mm-hmm. or the End Fund focuses on neglected diseases, and mm-hmm. five neglected diseases get them down to zero. But the people that are running those, Nick Rono for the Freedom Fund and Ellen Agler as the End Fund, they're the system entrepreneurs. They're the ones that are kind of saying, you know, join with me, donors,
mm-hmm.
that will be more effective together. And I'm not here to sell you that I have the answer, yeah. but I know together we'll actually have a better answer.
Bring it together, yeah, yeah. And they really understand and appreciate the full context of the problem. And
try to.
Yeah, try to. But and, I mean, they understand that the solution is going to have to take into account
that full
context.
But they're a note of action that others are drawn to then, saying, well, they've done more work on this than others,
yeah.
so let's join with them. You know, New Profit, that's what we're doing, is creating a lot of these system entrepreneurs and incubating them, saying, how do you partner, like we've been doing for 20 years, with social entrepreneurs? And in fact, a lot of social entrepreneurs now are becoming system entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wendy Kopp is now that for
yep.
Teach for All.
Mm-hmm.
When she started Teach for America, I call her a classic social entrepreneur. But she's evolved, saying, I want to look at this larger system. You know, that's what Gerald Achaving is doing in Europe. He's looking at this larger system of employment and skill-based employment strategies. So I think it's natural, not just for social entrepreneurs, by the way, but others to roll into this orchestration strategy.
Very interesting. Let me ask you two more things about philanthropy before we move on. And one of them is a relationship between the CEO and the board chair. And there's probably no more important relationship in a nonprofit organization. And it's so good to talk to you. I get to speak to a lot of CEOs, but not so many board chairs. So to be able to hear from your perspective will really be interesting. What are the elements of a healthy and a robust relationship, as well as the warning signs that the organization is about to suffer because that relationship is beginning to break down?
I totally agree that this critical relationship, because some people just talk about how the board versus the CEO, but actually the chair is so critical to making sure the board communicates well with the CEO, actually has a healthy culture and atmosphere when you're actually having board meetings so that they're constructive, they're mm-hmm. generative, right?
Mm-hmm.
Creating interesting thoughts and ideas and openings of networks. So when I arrive to a board meeting as a board chair and I'm working with the CEO, if I don't have people come out of the board meeting going, that was interesting, I really learned something. And if they didn't say also that, you know, I think I contributed something, I actually think what I said might have been helpful, then that's a great board meeting.
Mm-hmm.
If they think it was just a bunch of PowerPoints, you know, and somebody presented to them, or, well, gee, that was the only time we ever heard, you know, once a quarter we get together for a board meeting, that is terrible.
Yeah, I've been in a lot of those.
They're like, oh, my God. So the best and healthier relationships, in my mind, are constant contact with the CEO. So Vanessa Kirsch at New Profit, who's the CEO there, and I talk every Friday morning for an hour and a half.
Mm.
And we just talk. What's going on? What's important? What can I help with? What other board members can be helpful? Can I call them and kind of bring them in? Gee, you have a donor there issue? Let's figure out how to get that donor interested in what we're doing, right? Or you have a management issue, right? Well, whatever it is. So you become, hopefully, a partner in the process. And then you model that because you model that with others in the organization.
Yeah.
And other board members model that too. And so you each board member contributes something differently. And your job as board chair is to figure out how to match them. And it's that ensemble creation. It's that, you know, you play really well that
mm-hmm.
instrument, you know. So I got to hook you up with somebody that really needs that, right? As opposed to we're just kind of a mass of people who are there to control you. And that's it's a terrible strategy. And so the board chair is that conduit, is that connector.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about donors. You know, some organizations don't really have a lot of hands-on volunteer opportunities for donors, yet some of those donors are yearning for a personal connection with that organization. And you've spoken about this concept of avatars. Sounds interesting. What is it?
I believe in life that if I can find people who I wish I was, but it don't have time to be, which I call an avatar,
uh-huh.
then I'll support them. And so if I can have as many avatars in the world that I just love and that are really pieces of me in different forms, then why wouldn't I just support them?
It's a lovely concept.
With all knowledge, network, contacts, I don't care. Of course, they're me in a different shape and form. You know, awesome. So that's the deal. You know, is finding people like that. And so it gives me energy when I find people like that. You know, many of them are younger, you know, so maybe helping them, you know, get in there. Or somebody are passionate. And I have, you know, it's my old venture life. I do too many things. But figuring out those that I can work through and leverage It's my old CEOs of companies. Now these are not just social entrepreneurs, but these are system entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. These are others that are passionate. How do I engage them and help them succeed? And that does take many in the philanthropy world, I think, need more of this, some self-inquiry saying, you know, am I doing this well? Am I actually, do I have a managed ego? Do I try to pull my ego more out of it than I can? It's impossible to take it all, but, and then work on the bigger issue.
Mm-hmm.
And have some sympathetic joy. So sympathetic joy is defined as happy that others are happy and joyful and not jealous. And that's something I and hopefully many of us continue to work on sure that I'm not, oh, I wish I had that.
Yeah.
Oh, he has a great car. I wish I had that car. No, I'm just happy he has a car.
Yeah.
You know? And so how are we doing that in life?
Mm-hmm.
And getting people to help do that as well.
Well, one way to help do that is through mindfulness. And you, Jeff, were one of the earliest proponents, certainly in the business world, of mindfulness and meditation. What got you started down that road?
Yeah, the contemplative world is important to me, and it gives me that center. I started meditating in 1973 at the University of Virginia in the middle of a field. And I now am the outside chair of the Contemplative Science Center, where it studies meditation, and we're building a building right on that spot.
Wow.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, it really
very
is.
Strange when they told me that. I had no input into it at all.
Yeah. Well, they probably didn't know where you were laying on the field.
So. Well, that's, you know, when I'm a first year in college, yeah, they, who knows where we are. But that connection between self-spirit and others and understanding that we can meditate and modify our brains or mm-hmm. modifying our brain cells. And so understanding that working together to create people who have lower anxiety, lower depression, and these are all the things that I've been helping support over the years in research around that show that if you do have a long-term practice, your mind changes.
Mm.
You become, I think, a better person. You are able to focus better. You are able to be more collaborative. You're able to work in teams better. You're compassionate. I can show you, and there's lots of science now. We actually have science going through the FDA near approval for ADHD, for mindfulness. Instead mm-hmm. of taking drugs, isn't this better? And so we're using these tools to bring it to kids in schools. We're bringing in kids in higher ed and, mm-hmm. and early ed and using it in healthcare.
Yeah.
And so we help set up companies to do this and fund those as well. So it's been a center part of my life in the practice of that. I go on retreat twice a year.
Yeah, yeah.
I find many others who, you know, the CEO of Aetna is my sangha, my work group,
yeah.
you know, that kind of holds us all accountable because it's kind of hard to do by yourself. So if you kind of like, hey, how's your meditation going? You know, well, or how's your yoga? I mean, this is not selling one thing. It's really a whole set of practices that help us reform our mind and body to be a little more useful in the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said about the fact that you don't do this by yourself because I think many people envision meditation as being a solitary activity. And I guess there are opportunities and there are benefits in doing this in a communal way, correct?
Totally. It's different. I mean, it's okay to go by yourself. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You should do that. But it's a different experience. As live music is a different experience than recorded music, when I'm practicing with others, when I'm meditating with others, and then I'm having discussions with them afterwards, you know, as to how'd that go? What do you think? Oh, God, I was thinking a lot. You know, oh, okay. Well, that's okay.
Yeah,
you know,
have
to think about that.
Yeah.
Gee, there's a different kind of meditation you can do. There's a loving kindness meditation. Oh, what is that? You know, how does that work? So with others, you get better. And mm-hmm. with others, there's an energy feeling of just like jazz guys talk about, you know, something spiritual that's going on. I think that's true in the meditation space as well.
Let me ask you about mindfulness as it relates to an organization, particularly a nonprofit. You know, I think all of them are striving to become more relevant and become a magnet for talent. What can leaders do to create a culture of mindfulness?
It's a great question. And the business school started down this path before anybody else. So it's interesting that business can lead that.
Mm-hmm.
At Harvard, they call it authentic leadership. At Stanford, they call it touchy-feely. You know, Deepak Chopra teaches a course at Northwestern Business School. You say, wow. And now it's being infused throughout business. I taught meditation at J.P. Morgan.
That was a while ago,
20
too.
Years ago, yeah. And we had mindful leadership as well. And so it's not just about the problems, but it's also about the opportunity to improve yourself, to make yourself more effective. And Bill George, who writes about authentic leadership and does some great teaching, Scott Krenz, one of my partners, they teach at a place called 1440 Multiversity out in California that's a new retreat center about leadership and bring companies in and country managers in. And what they're finding is that people are working better in teams when they have these skills. They actually are lower incidences of anxiety and better higher end performance levels. There's all sorts of other aspects of the change, behavioral health issues. So now Cigna's adopting those programs with a company called Happify that's embedding it. We had another one we invested in called Headspace and Insight Timer and a bunch of others. So we have an investment group called Bridge Builders, which has seven of us now, who have joy in investing in this space. We don't have to. We can do other things. But we actually love with each other. And there's a guy named Charlie Hartwell who's our collaborative glue that kind of holds us together, right? You always need something like that, right? And we love to get in retreats together. But then you find a deal going, this Insight Timer thing, wow, there's 4 million people that have signed up. And there's a million users. And they have 2,000 teachers. And maybe we can bring these ideas out to the world. And there's other business strategies too. And then we can, in healthcare, start improving health by investing in companies that can bring these tools and techniques to medical students, to the understanding that we can bring these tools through academic research to make people's lives having lower suffering. And that's in my life, if I can lower suffering in the world, enhance joy, I'm done.
Yeah, that's.
And if I could do it through ensembles with others, I'm so done.
Yeah. Very nicely and very simple. That's what you want to do. Not a lot of complexity to that, but boy, profound. You mentioned teams before. How does mindfulness change the way teams can work together and become more effective and more engaged and, I don't know, happier?
That's an important point. Particularly in the new millennial and next-gen world, there's flat structures, and they're interested in working together on big issues and big problems and stimulating themselves. And so giving them the skills to actually lower the number of thoughts in your mind. You know, there's some, you know, half your thoughts are kind of extraneous.
Mm-hmm.
So we can say, oh, okay, you know, let me kind of
how did that get there?
Slow that down a little bit. Let me kind of think about that one. You know, expand the space between your thoughts. So giving these skills to people seems to allow them to be a jazz ensemble, play together well, listen to each other better, understanding there's a purpose for them doing this work together, and being open with each other starts opening the communication, kind of like, how are you doing this? And let me help you, and you can help me. Being a mirror to another is a really useful tool. If I don't have people who are my mirrors, who understand so I can see myself more clearly, my wife is a great one. She'll kind of like, you're not really owning up to what you promised. Or kind of like, you're...
Wives are good at that.
Yeah, where are you going on this one? So I think that's what happens in teams, for sure.
And you touched on a moment ago higher education.
Yep.
And boy, the pressures of grades, alcohol, and addiction, and sexual violence, and really just trying to fit in and be popular. Lots going on at that age. But you believe that these mindfulness tools can be very valuable, and you're doing something about it. What is it?
So at the University of Virginia, at Contemplative Science Center, we've teamed up with the University of Wisconsin, Richie Davidson there, and Penn State, Mark Greenberg and team, to create a course called Flourishing. And it's a first-year course. Mm-hmm. Get 3 credits. And it's a flipped classroom, so you read everything ahead of time, and then you actually just get and talk and work with each other in classroom. And they're talking about these issues because our student health services, I'm on the board of the University of Virginia, for example, and I was on the board of Berklee College of Music. There is more stress than when I was in college. There was still stress, okay, yes, but now somehow with technology, with sexual pressures, with drinking and everything else, so the student health services are at their wits' end. And so waiting until somebody's depressed and suicidal to show up in the student health is not the answer.
Right.
It's giving them the tools to be able to address these problems themselves or with others in their dorms, for example. And so what this course does is giving those set of tools. And by the way, it's not just mindfulness. It's whatever works for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a set of tools, as you say before. It might be yoga. It might be Qigong. It might be just talking.
We're all different.
It might be hanging out, you know. It might be kind of opening up to others and knowing that there's resources around and teaching teachers that as well. So the course is done great, and now we're talking to a number of other universities about using similar models for that flourishing style.
Yeah, fantastic. And even better than getting those tools to young people in college is to getting them to them earlier.
Yeah.
And at that University of Virginia Contemplative Science Center, you are looking at the younger students, and the proving ground for you is the 28th largest school district in the country, which is Louisville, Kentucky. Tell us about the Compassionate School Project.
Yeah, this is one that's been going for almost 5 years now. And we've teamed up with the local community foundations and the Brown family and a bunch of others to bring 25,000 kids, K through 5, kindergarten through 5th grade, the tools of mindfulness, yoga, social-emotional learning, and health. And, wow, if we could give tools like that to the kids at their early age so that we're not trying to fix things when they're 18 or 21, then we're going to have a better world. And so we've been doing this, and the results are through the roof. And 25,000 is not a small test.
No.
But it actually is a research project. And there'll be really great papers coming out of it. But the results are impacting Louisville. And it's been happening over the last couple of years, and they're embedding this program into their school system, which is the goal of a philanthropist, is to help support some of that. And if you can actually tie research into it to prove that the kids are in school more often, that the kids are performing better grade-wise, that they have the ability to not get into fights as much and some other things, which is all true, then isn't that a good thing? And so then we use those as models. And so what happens is this is a system change strategy at the city level, right? Mm-hmm. You're doing it in partnership with the mayor. The mayor is amazing, the superintendent, the schools, and figuring with them how to embed it, as opposed to saying, I have a nonprofit, and these are all good ones to innovate, but I have a nonprofit that is going to come give you this research.
Yeah, right.
And you have to do the following to allow me to bring it to your school system.
Yes.
It's just not a partnership mode. No. And that was really good. We developed those ideas, but I think we're all in this world now of starting to bring together lots of these different tools in being collaborative and working with the people who's going to be affected. And that's in proximity. And that's as close to the problem as we can get. You know, involving those people at that bottom part of the system and then being this collaborative glue, be this top around model that helps them get access to those tools to affect the change they want to see.
Well said. Well, let me close with this, Jeff. And maybe how you do what you do is unique to you, but there may be some advice there for others. I think the conventional wisdom in philanthropy is to, if you really want to make a difference, you need to focus your efforts on one or two things, maybe three. You've made a real difference, but it's been a lot more than one or two or three things. I mean, malaria, the Berklee School for Music, Harvard, the Contemplative Science Center we talked about, New Profit, Just Capital, Millennial Promise, the Lincoln Center, Film Society,
lots of things,
and so on. And that doesn't even include your business and your investments. Is there a secret to be able to juggle so many things and continue to bring vital and valuable contribution to each?
Having joy while you do it. And so if I'm not having a good time by the relationships that I have, or the collaborations I'm working on, I move on. Also dropping things, you know, when they're interesting in the early stages. I like the early stage idea. We're figuring stuff out. And once it becomes more mature, then I'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
I like to advise more than I like to be on a real board. I go on real boards.
Yes, you do.
But I'd rather work with a CEO or work with a great innovator or an orchestrator to accomplish the change we want to see and use my network to do that. And the network's a big effect. And so being able to introduce people to others, saying, I'm not going to do it for you, but I can hook you up with somebody that can. Or to unify and leverage off of other people so I can affect the change I want to see together is really important. So avatar effect, you know, understanding this ensemble effect, to my mind, makes my life, you know, more manageable enough that I can be involved in a lot of cool stuff.
Well, manageable enough that we were lucky enough to have you come here this evening. Well, Jeffrey Walker, the systems entrepreneur, if I may describe you as such, thanks so much for being here this evening. If people want to learn more about all that we talked about or your approach to the things we discuss, where can they go for additional information?
Well, you can go on Google and just call up Jeffrey Walker and look up some of my articles. And Bridge Builders is another one. And that's if you want to know about our investments in the contemplative space, you can look up Bridge Builders and see some of the investments that we have. Look up Contemplative Science Center at University of Virginia, and then go to New Profit. We're writing a lot of articles about system change as we speak, a lot of system entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs, and that newprofit.org.
And Bridge Builders is bbcollaborative.com, and it's a great gateway for people who are interested in meditation. Thanks, Jeff. It was great to have you on the program.
Great, Denver.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
The Business of Giving can be heard every Sunday evening between 6 and 7 p.m. Eastern on AM 970 The Answer in New York and on iHeartRadio. You can follow us at Biz of Give on Twitter and at facebook.com/businessofgiving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.